Welcome to the Frank Reactions podcast, where we discuss how you can get great reactions from your staff, your customers, prospects, and the public through better customer experiences online and off. My name is Temma Frank. If you've already heard my blurb about how we've been transitioning from Frank Online Marketing to Frank Reactions, feel free to just skip ahead to about the 2-minute mark. Otherwise, listen on. We've been transitioning gradually from the Frank Online Marketing Show to the Frank Reactions podcast over the last few weeks, but there's a fair amount of overlap because many of the companies that I interviewed on that show were being successful online because of how they were handling customer experience related issues. So I think there's a lot of insight there that listeners to this podcast can also benefit from. What I've decided to do is for the first few episodes, I'm actually going to replay some of the ones from Frank Online Marketing that really deal a fair bit with customer experience related issues. So if you are a longtime listener of the Frank Online Marketing Show and have already heard all those, I would suggest you just skip right ahead to episode 15, which is where we will have totally new, fresh content for you. If you're interested particularly in the online marketing side of things, I'd also suggest that you go back to the Frank Online Marketing Show and check out those episodes because there's a lot of real value in those as well. So next up is today's interview, and I hope that I'll get some feedback from you about what you think. I'd really be grateful if you would do a review on iTunes. It would be really exciting if we could get listed in their new and noteworthy column. And it would also be gratifying for me just to know that you're out there listening and to hear some of what you have to say about the show, because I am always looking for ways to make it better. Here we go. Today, I have the pleasure of presenting an interview I did recently with Peter Aceto, the CEO of ING Direct. Peter defies stereotypes in a lot of ways. He is trained originally as a lawyer, and, you know, when we think of lawyers, we tend to think of people who are pretty traditional and ultra risk averse. And yet, Peter was one of the first CEOs to actually get involved in social media, and he is quite active in social media. So we have an interesting wide-ranging conversation about why that is, how a company the size of his and in an industry as traditional as banking is able to manage the risks of being involved in social media, as well as issues like how modern communications and media can help with understanding their users better and doing better user research. Towards the end, we also discuss the importance of having empowered frontline employees, but also, how do you go about executing empowerment in a way that works? It's not an evident or easy thing to do. I'll chat with you briefly after the interview. You have been nicknamed the social CEO, and because you are quite active in social media, and most CEOs are quite reluctant to get involved in social media. So what made the difference for you? Why did you get active?
Really for two clear reasons. And I vividly remember sort of talking with a team of people with another company we were working with, and it was sort of a strategic discussion, and one of the conversations that came up was about social media and hearing, this is probably about 5 years ago, about 5 years ago, mm-hmm. You know, and we were talking about Facebook and Twitter and a variety of different platforms that existed at the time. And, it was very compelling to me. And, I can see in how the world is changing and how consumers are changing in terms of their trust of organization and their trust of leaders and demanding more transparency from everyone, from government, from corporations, from business leaders, from community leaders, a variety of things like that. I have always embraced sort of authenticity and sort of being real and being a lot more open about who you are as a person and how that enhances your ability to lead. So very quickly, started to experiment with social media, and I sort of started with Twitter and, in a corporate way, and really enjoyed it. So there's a couple things here about why. One is I know the world is changing, and I think I'm not alone in that regard, and I wasn't then, and I'm certainly not now, and that this way of doing business, this way of interacting with the public, this way of interacting with your customers and even your employees is going to be a best practice at some point in time. So I believe that. The second thing is when I look from a competitive perspective and I look at our values of ING Direct, I look at the cornerstones that our business was built on around customer advocacy, about openness and honesty and transparency, the weaknesses of our competitors, this was a place that our business, me as an individual, as the leader of the business, we needed to be, and that our competitors would find it very, very difficult for a long time to be there. So I think there was there's an external reason, and I think an internal reason about why I got on board, 5 years ago.
I started my career some 30 years ago working for the Canadian Bankers Association, and obviously things change in 30 years, but, and I'm going a little out of order here, but that's one of those things that really startled me with the Scotiabank acquisition, is because it seemed to me that their relatively stodgy culture was going to be a huge culture clash with ING Direct. How is that working out, and how do you make something like that?
It's a great question. Admittedly, one I've been asked before. So I'll begin by maybe giving Scotiabank some credit. So I'll acknowledge what you said. I mean, they're over 180 years old, right? So they clearly have a very we're 17 years old. They have a very different culture. They're a very important fabric, in this country, a part of the fabric of this country, and they're just different, right? I mean, they're very different than us. And I think what's so smart about those guys is when they first met us and they got to know us, they realized early on how different we are, right, from a cultural perspective in terms of how we think, how we run our business, the way the business is led, the way we interact with our customers. So I think they saw very early on that we're very different from each other. So if they did win and they did end up being our new owner, our new partner, that they would have to honor the differences between their business and our business, that what makes us special and different and distinctive is our culture and our people, and that if those things changed, our customers would feel it and would be unhappy. So it's delicate, but I think they deserve some credit early on to say they're a different company, they're a different brand, they have a different culture. If they're going to continue to be successful, they need to maintain those things. We need to maintain separation between the two businesses. Hats off to them. And that's where our hard work, I think, comes in, which is they still need to understand the business. We still need to explain things to them. And we need to have the ability to raise our hands and say, this is an area that, we don't think you should weigh in on, and those things. So they've been very good that way. And it's been a year and a half. We've grown our customer base significantly. We've grown our deposit base significantly. And we've got a very exciting plan for the future. So it's working.
I saw that you have grown your customer base and deposit base quite significantly over that time period. What do you attribute that level of growth to? Because obviously a lot of people worried after the acquisition that it would go the other way.
Yeah. I'll tell you, I attribute it to two things. One is something that we just talked about, which is Scotiabank's staying steadfast and true to their initial feeling that we need to be separate and distinct, and we oughtn't change. And so internally, the way we hire, how we hire, the culture of our business, where our offices are, how we interact with our customers. I mean, they've weighed in. They haven't weighed in at all on this matter. I'm the leader here, and my team is in place, and we run the business the way we ran it before. I think what's exciting is prior to that, we had a shareholder that was less interested in our growth because they were having their own challenges around the world. We now have a shareholder who sees us as a significant opportunity for us all to grow faster than the banks could otherwise, and they're giving us the room and the resources to grow our business and continue to evolve and change, and I think it's been very exciting, certainly as a leader, to have that support. And we've seen good results, and I think we're even more excited about the future.
Okay, well, that's great. So obviously one of the things that would be concerned traditionally in the banking industry is to have quite a bit of control over the message. And in the social media era, that you can't really have that level of control. So first of all, internally, and then in terms of how you deal with things externally, how do you ensure that a consistent message is being put out on social media about your
bank? Yeah, I think it's a great question. It's a two-part answer. The first one is the most important part, but the second one's also just a bit of realism and sort of practical execution pieces of it, which is we really are a principle-based organization, meaning we have values and principles that guide how we make decisions and guide how we hire people and guide how we promote and thus guide the decisions that are happening all around the building. While I'm on the phone with you for the next little bit, I'm sure there's 5, 10, 15, 20 decisions that are being made. I obviously am not in the room for all of them or probably even any of them. So we have principles that right. guide how we drive this business forward. And I think those principles are applicable to how you communicate with your customers, how you communicate with your employees. And social media is just a way of communicating with those groups of people. So we have principles and values, which the people who represent our business in social are guided by, right? So they can,
okay.
you know, they get probably an infinite amount of different requests and questions and requirements and all those types of things. So you need principles because you can't give someone a rule book about how to mm-hmm. answer every possible permutation, combination of question. So the first answer to your question is right. values and principles. We do, however, from a social perspective, have an enterprise social media tool. We use a great entrepreneurial Canadian company called Hootsuite out of British Columbia. So we have an enterprise Hootsuite license where we can get a second set of eyes on our social media communications. Now, not necessarily, not all interactions get a second set of eyes because it would be inefficient, right? However, you can look at all the communications and we can provide coaching and feedback and all those types of things. I'll give you a great example. You maybe you'll ask me about it, but you know, because we were sold, we have to change our name, right? Mm-hmm. So we're ING Direct today and in a few months we'll be Tangerine. And that mm-hmm. was because of the contract. I mean, we had no choice but to change our name, otherwise we wouldn't have done so. We did a full social media simulation around the announcement of our name change, right? Which is we partnered with Hootsuite and a few other companies and internally, and we simulated what will happen on the day we change our name. What type of feedback will we get? I mean, we actually got terrible feedback, good feedback, tough questions, mean stuff, and so that the team could practice that type of crisis scenario in a war room type of setting. Particularly for big things that you can sort of prepare yourself. It may be the first time that's ever been done. I'm not really sure.
That's very cool. And I mean, certainly for something that you can predict and that you know is coming. But it's not a bad idea to run simulations even for the unpredictable, I guess, just like fire drills.
Yeah, well, I mean, I have an example of that, too. And it was probably about a year ago, right around now, we came out with an RSP campaign. And the campaign was all around, it was meant to be clever and humorous. And it was around, RSP is an ailment, right? And that, we have a cure to your ailment, right? So, you have RSP, you don't feel good because you have RSP, right? Anyway,
right.
we we had that. It was we thought it was very clever. In our TV spots, we portrayed people not feeling well, right? Mm-hmm. And very, very quickly, we started through social media getting a response saying that we were making light of depression and mental illness, right? Which, of course, was not our intention, right?
Yeah.
And we never used the word depression. We never said depression was a symptom of RSP, but we portrayed people, and they were acting as if they were lethargic, depressed, unhappy, whatever. So through social media, we began to see a small conversation saying that we were making light of a very serious issue. The cornerstone of this issue is that there's a stigma attached to it, and people don't like to talk about it, and us making light of it exacerbates the problem. And, you know, I myself even received an email from a gentleman in Canada whose son took his own life in his first year of university and had been stuck. I mean, it was very, I mean,
wow.
I really connected with the problem in a way I never had. And probably about 6 days later, we pulled all of that advertising. I don't want to take any credit for it. We probably shouldn't have put it out there in the first place. And I think we learned a lesson about involving our customers in even the creation of this type of material to make sure we aren't missing anything. But certainly we reacted, and we had a negative business impact because we, you know, we took advertising off, so we didn't have the RSP season we were hoping to have.
Yes.
But we dealt with it, and we listened, and I was proud of the organization for doing that, although not proud that we made the mistake in the first place. But it happens.
So you say it took 6 days to make that decision to pull it. So what happened during those 6 days, and how did you ultimately make that decision?
Well, obviously, okay, so, you know, it all starts with one comment, and then one comment turns to two, and then I think you probably have an awareness of social media that it can get loud there. And I'd say probably all in all, you know, Facebook, Twitter, there was probably less than 100 interactions of any about the issue. There's 35 million Canadians. We've got 2 million customers. Mm-hmm. But there was something real about it, and we sensed, we understood the argument, and we watched it, and we thought about what our contingency plans would be. You know, like, can we modify the ads? Can we change the ads? Mm-hmm. Can we do something different about the ads? So it took a little bit of time to figure that out. So in hindsight, you know, those ads wouldn't have gone out at all because we would have been more sensitive to the issue. B, in hindsight, we could have and should have pulled the ads sooner. But I think it was a great lesson, and it was a decision that I, in the end of the day, made to remove, you know, the ads and that. So there's definitely lessons learned there.
So in terms of lessons learned, what sorts of changes in your processes would you use then going forward to deal with crises like that?
Well, firstly is, you know, we've always, certainly when it comes to service enhancements or product enhancements, like when we launched our Thrive checking account, we involved all of our employees in the creation of the product and the using of the product before we gave it to our customers. We also took 20,000 customers who used our checking account for several months before we made changes and things.
Okay.
But we had not done that, you know, with advertising, for example, right? So now we're working on advertising right now when we come out with our name Tangerine, or when we execute on that, and we are involving the social process to make sure there aren't blind spots like this. So we've added a new step to the process which should alleviate those types of surprises, although, you know, increase the chance that we won't have a surprise like that. I also think we now can be a little bit quicker, you know, about how we make that decision because we've sort of gone through the thought process of what you can do about it and how you react to it. So in hindsight, I think we've learned that you can avoid, you can increase the likelihood that you won't have a problem like that again. And I think that we could reduce the cycle time of how long it would take to fix a mistake.
So how do you, if you're going to involve the social process in things like development of ad campaigns, then you're basically losing the element of surprise that you might have had over competitors. How does that work out?
That's a good question, actually. And so look, so social, kind of go back to the definition a little bit of social, which is, that'll be the second part of my answer. First part of my answer is we're faster than our competitors. So our processes, our systems, all those things, we know that we're nimbler and quicker. So I truly believe that if ING Direct and one of our competitors, depending on the competitor, a bigger one, we make a decision on the same day, I'm confident that we can get that decision executed quicker, right? And in the market quicker. And hopefully in our area where we focus, we actually can make the decision quicker too, because we have a very flat organization and we're very focused in what we do, as opposed to being broader, more complex and those types of things. So we hope that we can make decisions quicker and then we can execute them quicker in our area. So I become a little less fearful about our competitors being able to do something about it, if we signal things, a little bit early. The second thing too is, you know, we talk about social today and we talk about Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and all that kind of stuff, but it's not really a new concept, right? I mean, people were always social. Mm-hmm. People, you know, they met in a physical way, right? Yep. They met in a church or a mosque or, you know, at the Sunday night dinner table as a family, and they talked about all the same things they talk about. Technology has just enabled that group to be much broader, and, you know, so you get the concept, right? So for a Thrive Checking account, we involved our employees, and that's social, and that's inside your walls. Now, look, I'm sure there's 10% of our employees who have a significant other who works in one of the big banks. So when we give it to our employees, we understand the possibility. We explain the sensitivity of it. Mm-hmm. But it's possible, right, that it could leak out. Now, it didn't, because I think our employees, they're pretty excited and passionate, right? And and know that it's best if it doesn't happen that way. But then also with our customers, right? Yeah, I'm sure it was very clear 2 months before we launched Thrive Checking that we were going to do Thrive Checking, and there wasn't really a notable response that sort of impacted our business. So we don't look at it that way. We just sort of drive forward. We try and be very thoughtful and we do things, and we see the benefit of involving the community. So in some cases, you know, like our tangerine advertisements, we might not use social from a Facebook and Twitter perspective. We may go to our customer base in more of a closed way, you know, in terms of focus groups or in terms of surveys that come by way of email. So we can do it in a more closed way. But still, I mean, I'm sure there's a significant portion of our customers who are employees of a bank as well.
Yeah. Now, you've also involved customers at times in naming products or developing products. How has that process worked, and what's been effective and what hasn't?
Well, I think the most notable example is the one I've already given, which is, you know, we decided we wanted to launch a checking account. We built the function. What we wanted to build was our customers had been saying for years that they would like to do transactions. They'd like us to be a part of their everyday lives, not just their savings account and their mortgage. So we wanted to build an account that would help them buy things, right? Now, we call it a checking account, so that certainly wasn't the vision, and it does look like a checking account in the end of the day. So we built the functionality and a customer experience that we thought was unique and different, and certainly tried to simplify things, bring technology to make things simple for people. And then we gave those chunks of functionality to our employees. So our bill payment module, for example, our mobile banking, for example, even our, we were the first bank in Canada to come out with remote deposit capture, where you can take a picture of your check and deposit it. Mm-hmm. I mean, our employees got to use that, all those bits of functionality, for a good, 4 to 6 weeks, to give us feedback about the user experience, about what was easy, what was difficult, what could be better. So right there, there's many instances where our employees are very involved. They may not have been involved with the creation, but they get to be our users and say, well, I had difficulty with this, or my phone has this operating system and it didn't work properly, or the images aren't clear enough. Is there a way you can make it easier for the images to be clear? Also, as I said, with the Thrive Checking account, we had 20,000 customers our first 20,000 customers were given the product for 2 months to use, and yeah. and we got thousands of bits of feedback about how to make Thrive Champion better. So there's a variety of examples about how we involve our customers and employees. It's sometimes through social channels and sometimes through more closed channels in product creation and feature creation. Absolutely. We're launching a credit card, and, you know, 45% of our customers in a survey 2 years ago said, I want you guys to get a credit card. And if you get a credit card, I will use your credit card. So, you know, what is our next product? I mean, has something to do with what our customers actually want from us.
Why do you think customers would care whether their credit card comes from your bank or somewhere else?
It's a good question, and I'll tell you, I know the answer. The answer is
okay.
This. When we launched ING Direct 17 years ago, and I was the eighth employee, so I can speak from experience of being here, that we wanted to create an experience. So we wanted to create loyalty between ourselves and our customers through honesty and transparency, great service and great value that would make them ambassadors for our business, right? We launched a product and give our customers in the mortgage area called the Unmortgage, where we advise our customers to pay their mortgage off as fast as they can. And we know that's in our short-term financial, not in our financial benefit in the short term.
Yeah.
It is in the financial benefit of our customers. And I think Canadians now get that, right? I mean, the people who
yes.
had more equity in their home are feeling much better today than others. And we do that because we want our customers to be loyal to us and to believe we actually are the only bank in this country or one of them who actually puts their interests first. And if they believe that, they're going to keep coming to me because they trust me. And they say, I want you to do what you did for savings and checking and mortgages to a credit card.
And, you know, kudos to ING Direct that you've always actually been very good about collecting user feedback. I know that from experience because my other business, Web Mystery Shoppers, we did 2 years worth of testing on some of your earlier iterations of your website mm-hmm. to get user feedback. And I was thinking of it when you were talking about the checking account, because I remember the first year we did this study, people were just hunting and hunting, they were convinced there had to be a checking account somewhere. Why can't I find
right.
it? So, it's great that you actually are involving customers. So I guess you've got a point there that using social media really is kind of an outgrowth of what has been a very customer-focused kind of process all along.
And I guess it goes almost to one of the first questions you asked about why, right? And, social, like being social isn't new, right? Asking people, you know, hey, where's your mortgage? How was the experience? How did it go, right? Is mm-hmm. normal, right? Particularly for bigger things, and your financial life is a big thing. So social is really technology facilitating that discussion. And now it lets me be at the dinner table when someone's having the conversation. So
yes.
Why wouldn't I want to be there and either listen or weigh in and what's even more powerful is it really facilitates ambassadors for our brand who say, wait a second, you know, I've been doing business with ING Direct for 3 years and I know you had this issue with regards to an ABM, but here's my experience and why they're better than the other
yeah.
guys. And it's way better to have you support me than have me support me. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
So it can be powerful. It can go both ways on you, though, right?
Oh, yeah. You make a mistake, you hear about it real fast.
Yes, you do.
Now, you commented that your organization is flatter than a lot of other organizations. How do you manage that structure?
When you compare us to our competitors, and I'm talking about, you know, the traditional sort of brick-and-mortar banks, we're a direct bank, so we have almost 2 million customers. We have 950 employees. So from an employee-to-customer ratio perspective, we're just in a different planet. Like, we're just different. We're
yeah.
different business models, right? I mean,
yes.
Most of the big five banks have as many branches as we have employees, right? Actually, they all have more branches each of them has more branches than we have employees. So they have more customers.
Wow.
But it's just a really, it's just a very different model. So we're narrow in our focus. You know, we don't customize solutions for our customers, right? We're a place where people who feel empowered to make some basic decisions can do some online shopping, and they can buy themselves and they can service themselves. So it's just a very different model. And, you know, we could add a million more customers, which is what we would like to do, and not double our employee base. I mean, it's very scalable in that way, because it's really a self-help model. So from a hierarchy perspective, we don't need lots and lots of levels.
Right.
We have 950 employees. 800 of them are here in the building I'm in, right? We can all be in one building together, which means my IT people, my strategy and decision makers, the people who are on the phones, the people who are in the mailroom processing, you know, your requests same day, we're all in the same building, right? So it's very powerful, right? To have a flat structure, to be collaborative, to move quickly, to disseminate information incredibly efficiently, right?
Well, and I've read that you actually go down and have lunch in the cafeteria with employees fairly regularly to get some of that communication flowing as well. Is that still the case?
We have, we were in two buildings before, so we're right now we're in this building here at Steeles and the 404. We used to be half here and half Gordon Baker Road, which was Finch and the 404. We've now signed a long-term lease here, and we're all together in the Steeles building. So we have a new restaurant upstairs, like it's ours for our employees, because we have over 800
yes.
employees here. Now the food is so good and so healthy, and there's such variety because we have so many people in one building. I go for lunch there every day with my employees. And sometimes I have to have a meeting and I do it over lunch up there, but 4 to 5 days I'll just go sit at any table I want. So I'll sit with some associates who in our operations group, in our lending group, in our marketing group, you name it. And sometimes we'll talk about what we did this weekend. Of course, lately we talk about the weather and our kids, and then oftentimes we talk about the business. And I think it's really helpful to break down the barriers and give people the opportunity to ask questions. And so, yes, I do it on probably more than ever, and I find it more rewarding than ever.
That's really exciting. I know we're pretty much at the end of our time. I do have one last
sure.
question about that, though, and about the management process. To what extent do your frontline staff have decision-making authority? How, you know, to use the jargony term, empowered are they really?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's hard to measure on a scale, you know, how empowered they are relative to others. So I'm not sure, I can't give you, a quantitative number. I'll tell you a philosophy and a lesson, and then where we're headed on this one, which is,
okay.
We all know that terrible customer experience thing, right? And I think it's a direct model like ours is very vulnerable to it, right? Which is, we all know that things are good until things go bad. And then when they go bad, you call someone on the phone, odds are they're not going to be able to help you. So you kind of already know you need to escalate it once. Maybe you need to escalate it twice. You need to get to the manager. You know the vocabulary. We think you got to pierce right through the vocabulary. And I think that's the genesis of your question. So right from the very beginning, our phone people, anyone who interacts with our customers. So we've got some banking operations who speak to our customers, our call center people who also do all of our e-services. So click to chat, emails, our social team, all those guys, right? So we needed to change this continuum and give those people the power to make decisions, solve problems, apologize if it's necessary, and fix right on the spot. So yes, that is always one of the principles and part of our values. One thing I've learned is executing empowerment is harder than it sounds, right? People say, yes, thanks, I'm empowered, I can do whatever I want, but they need knowledge, and they need confidence, and they need experience so they can feel like they're making the right choices now that they have this power, right? And if they make lots of mistakes, then they're getting coached, and then they feel less confident. And so I think if you want to empower people, you need to train them and give them confidence, give them really smart coaching, and mm-hmm. while maintaining their confidence, so they really feel that they can solve problems. So there's a principle there, there's a lesson there, and of course we see it as a differentiator for us that, when we come up with a product change, or if we change rates, or if we launch a new product, all my contact center people are right here on the sixth floor. I'm on the ninth floor. We also have our bilingual team in Moncton. So there's 120 of them. We got a great leader running that space too. So I can make a change. I can have it executed by the end of the day, and them certainly scripted, coached within a week. So we can move really quickly. So we want more empowerment, which means we need better. We need more coaching, and we teaching. So I think we get it right a lot through the compliments we get, but we don't get it right all the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I guess having the open communication means that at least you find out about it in relatively real time, so you can do something about it. There are a few interesting things that I took out of this interview that I think would be valuable regardless of the size of your organization. One is the notion that transparency in social media, you can actually use that as a weapon against your competition, particularly if you're in an industry that's traditionally been very closed door. You can leverage the fact that you are radically different by being open, and it wins you a lot of attention and support among customers. Second is the importance of having strong values and guiding principles for your social media team to use as guidelines when they're trying to respond to situations that arise. You can't possibly give them all the answers in advance, but if they share core values and principles with the rest of the organization, they're likely to respond in the correct way most of the time. Another important lesson, I think, from what Peter had to say is the importance of getting user feedback when you're developing new products or planning new marketing campaigns. Of course, my background is usability tester. I obviously harp on that one a lot, so it always does my heart good when I hear someone else talk about it. And I thought it was a very interesting concept as well, the notion of doing a crisis communication simulation in your organization. Try to think of all the worst things that could happen, the worst things people could say, and test it out. See how your staff respond. I think that's a brilliant idea. And I guess the last little thing that I took from it is what I like to call management by lunching around. I love the fact that he sits down most days and has lunch with employees from all levels of the organization. That is so useful and so powerful for him and for building a team that cares.
I'd really love to get your feedback on today's episode. You can always reach me by email, Tema, T-E-M as in marketing A, at frankreactions.com. You can always leave me a telephone message on our toll-free line, which is 1-866-544-9262. If you'd like to check out the other episodes or the blog, visit frankreactions.com. And you can always subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. And if you would be so kind as to put a review in iTunes, that would be absolutely awesome, because then other people can also discover this show more easily. You can also, of course, find me on Twitter at Tema Frank and all the other basic social media places. I look forward to chatting with you again in 2 weeks.